This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Today, I'm going to be talking a little bit, as you can see in the title, on the issue of research study populations and how the importance of community engagement to help address diversity, equity, and inclusion. So this cartoon here illustrates how some individuals feel when they participate in research potentially. And the question is, if study participants are subjects, where is the humanity in human research? Nobody wants to be a study subject. I don't think what study participants want is to be informed volunteer participants that contribute to the greater good. We've certainly found that in some of the dialogues, the many dialogues we've had with a variety of different study participants. So to many, research may in fact feel like this. As you can see there in the back, you have the study participant in a jar being worked on, as it were. The institutional review board providing some oversight, and really the institutional review board is there to protect individuals and make sure that their participation is voluntary and so on. And then way in the background, in terms of pharmaceutical or therapeutic studies, you have the Food and Drug Administration also kind of looking in the back. So yes, you could have this feeling that you're being watched. But while research may feel like this, in reality, it should be about this. It should be about broad participation. And this circle of individuals working towards a common good, the idea, the accomplishment that's trying to be reached, everything from therapeutics, devices in terms of clinical, to better health promotion and prevention activities, interventions, and so on. This circle of individuals should include everybody, the investigators, actual participants, the community as a whole. So it should feel a little bit like that, this broad participation. It should be diverse discovery, right? Putting together this puzzle that we're all a part of, because ultimately, it doesn't matter. Even bench scientists, basic scientists who are working with tissue, with animals, ultimately, the idea is that their work is going to benefit human beings, more or less, right? Or somewhere in that pipeline of discovery. And the more diversity we have in that, whether it's gender, race, ethnicity, sexual and social orientation, and so on. These are all important elements. And ultimately, when the information is gathered, having broad dissemination, what happens is down here at the bottom, right? You have presentations at scientific meetings. These are kind of like the initial results. And then eventually you have publications, peer-reviewed publications in a variety of journals. But this other part on the top here, which I call basically practice dissemination, has to do with getting the results to community and getting it to community in a form that's understandable. Even these graphics that may appear very confusing are actually probably more understandable in terms of the things that are healthy versus unhealthy for us. Everything from cardiovascular movement, eating right, being an appropriate weight, physical activity, and so on, versus the bad things, right? Tobacco, the number one preventable cause of disease in the world, the use of therapeutics, excessive alcohol, and so on. So this broad dissemination and appropriate vehicles and content is very important in the work that we are doing. So this is an example is one knowledge transfer approach. This looks a little bit complicated, but at the end of the day, the take-home message here really is that it's very important to have the stakeholder identified problem. That what that means is that the issues that you're trying to address has input from the individuals that it's going to impact the most. And you'd be surprised. One of the key issues right here with regards to question and methods is that most research questions don't have stakeholder input. The questions and the study aims or so on are being developed by academics, and that's pretty much it. So an approach that includes others within that process is very important. And up here, you have academic dissemination, right? The publications and so on. But if you move down to the bottom section, the knowledge transfer that occurs down here, the contextualization of knowledge, these other dissemination components, those other little graphics that we just saw in the upper right, the application of that knowledge, and then assessing the impact of that knowledge along that continuum is very important. So this translation approach. So we're going to talk a little bit about these four things in a little bit more depth. So a review of the challenges that some investigators face in recruiting and retaining diverse study participants, the implications for interpreting and applying results, and exploring how community-engaged research approaches can help prevent and address issues of diversity, equity, inclusion, and health research. So in terms of the challenge, and this will all be fairly quick, I hope that this will spur some questions, develop some questions, and we'll have a robust conversation and get into a little more detail depending on your interests. So challenges. Some investigators have these issues with recruiting of certain cultural, racial, ethnic groups, and so on. Often, this is largely because of a lack of community-engaged research training. It's a capacity issue. And that training isn't just for the principal investigator, you know, the faculty, but it's also for the staff that is largely responsible for the recruitment and retention of participants, trainees, whether it's professional trainees, postdocs, and so on, or other students. There is a lack of infrastructure to develop that capacity. Often, we're missing language and cultural concordance with regards to a variety of populations here in the San Diego, along the border, and so the San Diego region, the border region. You have a lot of immigrants, a lot of bilingual and monolingual Spanish speakers. In other parts of the country, you have a lot of other different cultures. So the culture and the language of the populations you're trying to work with, having the leadership that understands the culture and the language, it speaks the language, and or staff is very, very important. And this goes a long way in terms of knowing how to address the issues of recruitment and retention with regards to studies, and not applying the golden rule. So we'll get a little bit into that. The lack of community-engaged research training in particular, there are actually some key principles, which we will talk about. I'll bring up a little bit later in terms of what those exactly are. But using very specific frameworks and principles that exist is very important related to community-engaged research and having those end recipients, those stakeholders involved. Missing language and cultural concordance, it really is about the team, as I mentioned. Who are the leaders and the principal investigators in particular? What kind of experience do they have in working with specific types of populations? If you are doing a study with women and the men, and it's only men in as principal investigator and so on and so forth, I think you're going to have some issues. I, for example, am part of a national consortium called PLUS, Preventing Lower Urinary Tract Symptoms in Women, that's trying to define what bladder health is for women. And guess what? The principal investigators are pretty much women. I was brought in for my expertise in working with Latina women in particular. I'm not a woman. I'm not a Latina woman. But, and I wasn't part of the focus groups, for example, that were done initially. But my experience culturally, linguistically, has contributed significantly to that team. And that was one of the things that I contributed and was brought on to do. So who are the leaders? And who represents the study participants in their communities? Do those folks have a seat at the table? The community advisory board approach, for example, where you bring a group of people, can only go so far, right? And they meet quarterly often with a team. They're not necessarily part of the team. So the language and cultural concordance has to be kind of built into this process. The golden rule, I do believe in the adage that when it comes to investigation and life in general, I mean, you do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. You want to treat others the way you want to be treated. And it's the same kind of thing. I think many of us have, particularly now with COVID, have been exposed to these subtleties, well, not in some cases, not subtleties, but if you have an emergency room visit, you see how stressed everybody is there. And sometimes you don't get answers when you want answers or when you need answers to be able to pass on to family. And as a study participant, it could be the same kind of issue. You know, you're not making an informed decision. I would not be surprised that, particularly in therapeutic studies where medicines or devices are involved, I would not be surprised if individuals do not know what they're signing up for in terms of the detail. And particularly if they're from different cultures and speak different languages, they may not be fully consented and be fully informed volunteer participants. So following the golden rule and really thinking through, if you were sitting there as a study participant, what would you want to receive? Obviously, the obvious things, you know, being treated with respect and so on, but really being informed of what it is that you're getting into. The implications for interpreting and applying results, there are two things that I think are particularly important. One is the scientific term of generalizability, which basically gets into the design issues in a study where you can speak to broad populations. And this is where randomization comes in of individuals that are being selected. But we won't get into all those design issues. But one of the things that's very important is And this is an example from Nature, the journal Nature, on how some of our most advanced work that's happening right now, everything having to do with omics and genetics and so on, how some of these larger studies that are being conducted do not have racial ethnic diversity. Pay attention to this red bar with regards to some of the major genetic attributed studies that have been taking place. The majority of participants in those studies are of European descent, in this case, 78%. When you look at populations that are particularly important to our region, for example, Hispanic Latinos, 1%. In other areas, African descent and so on, 2%. You know, Asian Pacific Islander, another very, very large group in our area, 10%. You know, this really has huge impacts in terms of generalizability and what you can say about populations outside of European descent with regards to genetic diversity in those data that are being collected. The other issue is timeliness. There's quite a bit of dialogue that has happened in the last decade, I would say, about this very, very long process of where you begin a research study to the point that you actually end up with some practice relevant information. And the average is about a 17-year process, which is an incredibly long time. And we're going to get a little bit into that. But basically, part of this has to do with, again, this issue of the focus of the research not really taking communities and stakeholders into account from the get-go in terms of those questions, so that you're really addressing and developing information that is relevant to those individuals and communities in a more applied way. And that's how you get into a lot of these time lags. There obviously are other complexities in terms of the funders and the approaches that are being used in science and discovery, which are lengthy. But I would make the case that not having community stakeholders actively engaged from the beginning does impact the kind of information that is being collected. So in terms of some of the approaches for community-engaged research that can actually help prevent inequities and address diversity, equity, and inclusion, as a researcher, if you are involved in research and you're involved in anything related to the community, you've heard of CBPR, which is community-based participatory research. This is an approach that really takes into consideration the green and purple elements that you can see here. The more traditional approaches are over here on the left, where, and I won't go into all of this, you can read, but basically the researcher defines the problem versus on the full community-based participatory research where the community identifies a problem and works with the research or works with the researcher to identify a problem. Again, that 17-year lag is really shortened because if it's a 5-year grant, you already are addressing issues that are relevant to the community and gathering information that will hopefully have some of the elements that are necessary to have impact locally. And as you move down this list, the focus, for example, down here, another thing to look at is the information itself. This is on the dissemination end, right? So researchers own the data in the traditional model. They control the use and the dissemination versus on the community-based participatory research approach where data are shared, and that should be R, not is, where data are shared and researchers and community decide its use and dissemination. This is particularly important in communities, in smaller communities, where they value their sovereignty. Typically, American Indian communities, for example, have various layers in there in terms of review, because you can identify the community and the individuals within that community, which gets into all kinds of ethics and a variety of other confidentiality issues in regards to population or even individual participants. So here are some of the principles behind community-based participatory research, which I've already alluded to. So recognizing the community, building the strengths, building on strengths and resources within the community. This is what I would call an asset model, not just a deficit model. Like, even, you know, this isn't just a problem issue. What are the resources that the community brings potentially in addressing or attempting to address a specific issue? Promoting co-learning and using an empowering process. Capacity building is really, really important for sustainability. And then the growth, really, discovery isn't a one-off, you know, activity. Research and discovery builds upon itself year after year, decade after decade. And if communities are partners within that process, they too are building. And this term that is kind of being used, but the citizen scientists, for example, and the appreciation for science and the value for science is all being influenced within that process as we engage individuals more. So when I talked about some specific principles that can be used for community engaged research, this is an example on what kinds of principles you would take into consideration. One of my students, Christine Hitella, gets full credit for creating this wonderful slide for one of the classes that I teach on community engaged research, which focuses on these principles. But before the work begins, clarifying the purpose and the goals with the population, knowing the community, right? This, you know, typically researchers start engaging research or the community, if it's going to be a community engaged study, they start approaching them like once the grant announcement comes out and they have 2 or 3 weeks, or maybe if they're lucky, a couple of months to get the grant ready. Well, that's way too late. You should have made those friends and get to know the community that you want to work with months or years before that. Once you kind of get going, or working with those established relations, you know, establishing the clear relationships and commitments, really respecting collective self-determination. When you have true partnerships, all these community-based participatory research principles, this is going to be one of the key things, right? That you respect the self-determination of what the community is saying. And your interests, hopefully, you know, you were working with them way early so that you were on the same page. But unfortunately, like I said, often you get into these relationships and they're not very solid. And all of this kind of goes to the wayside. And then for success, the partnering, recognizing the diversity, working with assets in the community, being flexible, and the researcher potentially releasing control in terms of what's happening, and then thinking about the long-term commitment, the sustainability. There's a lot of detail that goes into a lot of this, but you know, you get a sense of the full gamut of what community-engaged work can bring and what it takes in terms of time and building trust and those elements. Here's an example at the Morris Cancer Center, MCC, the Morris Cancer Center. One of the clinical trials approaches that we're using that takes a lot of this into consideration. In therapeutic trials in particular, you do need a systematic approach, and you do need and want leadership support. You want center-wide policy behind that support. We want to increase, for example, Hispanic numbers if they're low in terms of a specific disease team, you know, breast, lung, cancer, head and neck, you know, in the cancer world, the oncologists, the specialists are kind of, they focus on their disease site. And they're doing trials, right? And they have the clinical trials office has support for a lot of these things. But what do those numbers look like in terms of the involvement of certain populations and so on? So involving having center-wide policy, having an infrastructure. And at the clinic level, at the clinician level, this is where the rubber meets the road, right? What's the patient-provider relationship, patient-specific cancer treatment options? What's that provider encounter look like? And I'll give a little more detail in terms of, you know, how you would address that in a cultural and language concordant way with the ultimate goal of increasing clinical trial accrual among the given diverse population that you're trying to work with. So in this example of the clinical trial at the practice level, the recommendations there, these should kind of sound familiar based on what I've been saying. Language and culture concordant staff and study team, right? If you're going to be recruiting individuals from a given culture or with a given language, well, you want to have staff that have that, that the materials that you're using have been adapted, not just translated, but adapted to those cultures, the study consents in particular, any study information and so on. The cultural competency that's required to work with these communities. There are certain communities or immigrants, for example, that just defer to physicians. They basically say, you know, it's not uncommon to generalize a little bit, but it's not uncommon for less acculturated Latinos to basically just defer to the physician. Si, doctor, si, doctora, you know, whatever you say, that's what I want to do. And the clinician, you know, that's not a mutual decision. That's like, tell me what to do. And that's not what it's about, right, in terms of this work. But you can see some of these examples very much relate to those items that I've talked about. So in summary, we can help meet the challenges of addressing key health disparities in research participation by actively including communities and potential study participants early and often. This is the whole community-engaged research, building those capacities at both the academic side and with the community partners. And just being very cognizant that, particularly as, you know, the left-hand circle of those principles where we were talking about getting to know the community, well, get to know the community way before you start thinking about your research. That takes time. But that yields immense, immense advantages with regards to building trust, building understanding, right? And that also helps inform what your partnered leadership should look like, right? It's not just the investigators from the academic side, but the investigators from the community side being part of that team throughout and being at the highest levels. Compensation. The folks don't and shouldn't work for free. Participants, you know, you do have this potential for undue influence as you give incentive to participants, but certainly the staff in your community partnership that are helping you recruit, retain, and then with the dissemination, you know, they should be compensated for that. And then the practice dissemination that I talked about is so important to gather information, not just your study findings, but the process itself, to put it in word levels that are understandable and easy consumable, and also in vehicles that are appropriate, not necessarily PowerPoints, right? It might be social media and common language summaries and those kinds of things. And then from the very beginning, because as I said, science and research is iterative and really progressive, you want to talk about long-term relationships and what's the sustainability, not just of the relationship or the program that you're trying to develop, that kind of gets implemented somewhere, but that that everything grows upon itself and it's a partnership, right? And so that's very, very important. So thank you so much for the opportunity. I look forward to a very robust conversation.
Thank you, Jesse. That was excellent. I much appreciated. And so many of our programs this year, so much of our everybody's conversations this year have been about COVID-19. And we know that there are all sorts of reasons that there are disparities in the impact of the disease, in the impact, in the differences in people's willingness and ability to get the vaccine. So Could you speak a little bit to the importance of what you're doing to address those issues? What would change by what you're doing? What might we hope for in an aspirational way that would be possible?
For those of us doing population-based research, we were quickly pulled in to address some of the issues related to disparities for COVID specifically. I'm actually a lead investigator on a large National Institutes of Health grant under this infrastructure called RADx UP, which is Rapid Assessment and Diagnostics. And the UP is a subgroup of grants called focused on underserved populations. And I have other colleagues that are part of the call, or at least they were part of the call earlier. Dr. Corinne McDaniels-Davidson at San Diego State is also part of another RADx UP grant with San Diego State. And basically, those of us who have been doing population engaged work were already kind of clued in and had partnerships, in my case, with community health centers. If you're not familiar with community health centers or federally qualified health centers, these are the settings where poor folks on the federal insurance side, Medi-Cal or Medicaid everywhere outside of California, get their primary care. And in our area, about 67% of the patients there are of Hispanic descent in terms of culture. 99% are in poverty and so on and so forth. So those of us who have been working with those populations and the relationships that we have, we're kind of poised to continue those relationships to look at specific areas. In our case, testing. And, ironically, within 4 or 5 months, we've pretty much shifted away from testing and over into vaccination. So the information that we're gathering really is going to be like the next wave of testing, so it's sustained testing. So teams or scientists that were more population-centric, I think, had an advantage in working with and addressing, in this case, COVID-specific disparities.
Yeah, I was that's a very important part of the story. I was thinking about another aspect though as well, which is the research itself. I mean, why there's reason to believe based on what we've been seeing that a systemic history of the way different communities have been dealt with means that some communities are at more risk of illness, and we just haven't done the research to be able to know what we should be doing. And as examples in some fields include the fact that the someone's racial history might mean a difference in responsiveness to certain drugs or increased risks of certain diseases, and yet those groups have not been part of the research.
Yeah, again, one of the comments that I made is that as individuals, we usually feel the most comfortable around our own groups, quite frankly. Linguistically, culturally, and so on. And researchers aren't any different. So if you're of a certain gender or of a certain racial ethnic group, language, for example, I think language is actually quite a good example. Most of us are kind of used to functioning in English, right? So working with individuals that don't speak our language or are of a significantly different culture is a little bit more difficult. And quite frankly, that's what's happened historically. I mean, if you think of the capacity, that's setting aside the just straight out racism, which is very real, quite frankly, or sexism in some cases, right? Right now, for example, we have certain subpopulations, sexual orientation, gender identity, individuals that are not binary, binary gender-wise, in other words, man, male, or female. And there are so few researchers or self-identified researchers that are of that population or have really worked with that population that it's even difficult to know what language to use. For those of us outside of the SOGI community, slowly in the last year and a half, you've been seeing the pronoun, right? Oh, here's my pronoun, he, she, he, she, they, them, and so on. And it's starting to raise consciousness about that specific population. But that's kind of what seems like an almost an extreme example. But as a researcher, if you don't even have the vocabulary or you don't know how to work with those populations, the research isn't going to get done with those populations. So I think that's kind of one example.
Good, thanks. So we have a question in the chat about how you find the communities pertinent to your research. And I think there's a lot of ways you could go with this, but specifically, the individual is interested in the problem that often ethnic communities along certain boundaries are often very politically divided. And so I don't know whether you've addressed that sort of question in your own research or thinking.
Yeah, I don't think it's as much the political division issue as it is that as researchers, one of the things that the whole research enterprise forces you to do, particularly the funders, whether it's federal funders like the National Institutes of Health or other organizations. In my case, for example, in cancer, I do cancer prevention research. The American Cancer Society is a very significant funder. And then you have other nonprofits. What happens in research is that by design, you are very, very narrow because the way that things are laid out is you have a question and you have a hypothesis on what you think the answer to that question is, and then you develop specific aims on what information you're going to collect to answer that question. So you're fairly narrow, and once you have a narrow area, it isn't that difficult to figure out which kind of populations, if you're dealing with human participants, you're going to go work with. So I'll give you an example. In my case. So I focus not just on individuals as in patients, for example, but the individuals who serve them. So clinicians and also the leadership within the structures that serve them. So administrators within clinics. So my focus area is cancer prevention. And in cancer prevention, if you go to the screening side, there are really only three cancers that we screen for systematically. And we all know what they are. They're basically breast, mammography, colorectal cancer. It's either going to be a fecal test or a colonoscopy, or cervical cancer. And it's it's basically going to be a Pap or an HPV test. So in my world, it's like those three things, and it crosses both genders, right? But the populations, and I narrow it down even further, right? I'm interested in working with underserved or poor populations. Where do those screenings happen? They happen in these primary care settings, in our case called community health centers. That's for poor people, that's primarily where they happen. So now I'm basically narrowed down. Let's say I'm focusing on colorectal, which is the area I work on. So that's both genders. So there's not a gender thing. If I were doing cervical, it's women. So this is just an example of how things kind of get whittled down into these groupings. Once you know those groupings, well, in my case, it's colorectal, so it's both genders. It's poor folks, so it's community health centers. And that's kind of my universe. In San Diego County, there's an umbrella organization for most of the 17 community health centers, Health Quality Partners. So I'm going to go make friends with them. And there are I'm going to go to the databases that talk about those community health centers. There's a webpage because they're all funded by the Health Resources Services Administration, HRSA, and they have data on them. And I'm going to look at the characteristics of these specific health centers. And by the way, if I were specifically interested in racial, in Asian Pacific Islanders, for example, there are a couple of health centers that focus on that. Operation Samahan, for example, or San Isidro Health, which has significant Asian Pacific Islander populations. Or in the north, the largest Asian Pacific Islander or the largest Asian population in our county is Filipinos, right? So where do they live? Historically, they live in the National City. Now they've kind of moved up over into the Bernardo area. So you just kind of look at what the data are. You go to those sites and you start making friends, as I mentioned in my talk, preferably way before you start writing any grants.
Yeah, no, this is really important. And it's easy to see how important this is to have the right people involved and making sure that we have the full spectrum of the community involved in research. And it seems self-evident that we should hear the voices of the people who will be asked to participate in the research, that we should be engaging the right ones. But as you noted, It's clear a study with participants, for example, who are women or Latinos, that they should have a role in that. But it also seems obvious to me that some identities might be more important than others, depending on the question you're asking. So that might vary depending on the focus of the research, but how should we think about choosing which identities are most important? So, for example, there's a lot of conversation right now about racial identity. There's been a lot of conversation for some time about gender, and both are clearly important. But I could imagine other kinds of identities, like being a single parent or economic circumstances that might be important. So how should we think about that? Who makes the decision about which identities we should be worrying about that might be underrepresented?
There are well-proven frameworks or structures. One of the broadest ones is called the social determinants of health. And honestly, Europe has been ahead of us on that. Michael Marmot, for example, Dr. Marmot, who has been a champion for, if you want to keep a population healthy, get those people jobs, number one. That's kind of an adage there. In demography, when I was at Cornell back in the 80s, one of the things that I learned in demography is if you want to keep the birth rate down, what's the number one thing you can do? Educate women. Educate women. That's how you keep the birth rate down. So those are like at the higher level, the social determinants of health, employment, health indicators, and so on. You can begin to come down and look at other types of frameworks, like the socio-ecological model that looks at various growing circles, starting with the individual and what are the characteristics of the individual, and then going to the family and then the neighborhood and so on. And you basically go all the way up to society. And, you know, these identities or these important variables, as it were, within each of those levels, contribute to the ultimate impact, which is somebody's health and whether there's an inequity or a disparity in terms of a specific group of people. And the truth is that we know the answers to a lot of things. We don't have the political will in some cases, or in other cases, the true leadership that's needed to put the resources and put the emphasis on the things that are most important. And I'll give you an example, and this is the area that I work in, prevention. Our society here in the U.S. is basically disease-driven in terms of health. It isn't health, it's disease-driven. And we're driven towards curative medicine, not prevention. There are countries that have emphasized prevention, Australia, New Zealand, for example, on the cancer front. One of the best things that we can do to prevent six different cancers, starting with cervical cancer, is get everybody vaccinated for human papillomavirus. There are countries like Australia, politically, financially, have put their resources in, and they've reached levels of 70, 75% coverage, and they are beginning to see the disappearance of precancerous HPV-associated disease. That's an example of a priority area that was a disparity where resources were correctly applied and you reduce that disparity or eliminate it. In this country, we know what the problems are. We know what the solutions are. We just don't apply them.
Okay, so well, that begs the question then. So what should, what would you invite the audience to do? How do we fix this? What is this an education issue? Is it a voting issue?
Yeah, let me get political. How do we get Trump in office? And how do we get rid of Trump? It's the exact same thing. Look, folks who have been around for a while, they know somebody called Saul Alinsky, for example, and I'll show my leftward leaning in terms of politics, or Paulo Freire, for example. These are individuals who have basically shown us the importance of the individual or groups of individuals. Margaret Mead, I think the saying is, there's only one thing that has changed the world, and it's, two organized people or whatever. I can't remember the exact saying, but the way you get things done is you basically have a group of individuals who are on course and stay on course for an extended period of time on a specific issue. And in our society, The big issues, quite frankly, are solved through our elected officials. But unfortunately, our elected system has a lot of challenges. And that just is propagated throughout the world, right? We say, or we feel that democracy is the best way to go and blah, blah, blah. But it's interesting because, like I said, there are other countries in the health arena who have much, much better policies than us and have much, much healthier populations because of the decisions that they made. And that's because individuals got into it. But more importantly, those individuals were able to influence their leadership, you know, at the municipal, the county, or the national level to make these tough decisions and make the correct investments.
Great, thanks. So actually we got a couple, I've got more questions, but we've got a couple of others from the audience. I'm gonna go through those. So someone says they are on the organizational training and enrichment work stream of the Anti-Racism Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Task Force, which is a long name. What kinds of training would best prepare our research workforce for engaging in culturally humble community partnerships?
Well, that's what I'm trying to develop, quite frankly, under the Altman Clinical and Translational Research Institute. But one of the things in the presentation that I talked about were these principles for community engagement, or this model of community-based participatory research. Those are frameworks and models that have the key elements, and they're specifically geared towards academics. But that's only half of the equation. And when I say academics, I'm not talking about just professors, just faculty. I'm talking about the staff that work with them, the students that they're training. So it's the entire academic enterprise that's going to be involved in discovery. But the flip side of that is the capacity building with community partners. The community partner, in order for them to know what the most important thing is when it comes to research, the most important thing in research is the research question and the study aims that follow. That guides everything else. So the community really should understand that that is the most important thing, number one. And number two, well, how do we contribute to those research questions and those aims? How do we become an active partner? Remember the right-hand side of the community-based participatory model, the active partner, the true partner. And how do we ensure that of this multi-million dollar grant that we're being compensated so that our time is in fact part of that enterprise? Now, having said all this, part of the problem that we have in academia and in research is that the current funders and the current research models that we have do not lend themselves to this partnership very well. Part of it is the timing. Part of it is the fact that it's coming to academic institutions. They're not really set up. You know, the academic institution then sets up the contract for the money transfer with everybody else and so on and so forth. There are a couple of mechanisms out there that try to do a better job with that. For example, PCORI, Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute funding. But even there, I can tell you that it's not quite there. I think we have a little ways to go, and it's an entire structure kind of thing.
This one is this next one is they're saying the science behind what you do is a mystery that deters people from participating. I'm going to broaden that. I think they're arguing that the science behind what we in academia are doing is a mystery to people. They are afraid.
Yeah.
You provide basic information about the medical issue and what you are planning to do. Example at hand is the COVID vaccine. People don't know what clinical trials are, therefore do not associate them with why it is known the vaccine is safe.
Yeah. So let me tell you this. No, when I say the capacity building of the community side, you know, to get in there and do this and do that, there are certain things that we have to be very realistic about. And that is the years that it takes to become a scientist, right? My path. So 4 years undergrad, 2 years master's, 4 years doctorate. That's 10 years outside of high school to do research and do this and do that. Well, somebody who, even with an undergrad degree, they're not going to get the that level of research capacity. So there does have to be, there are certain components or certain pieces that that are going to distinguish the general public or non-trained individuals from trained individuals. And, so that piece of it is very real. But I tell you where scientists drop the ball is not, and I try to show that in the presentations when I was talking about the dissemination side, where we have a huge infrastructure to how to present our findings to our colleagues, right? That's the scientific meetings and manuscripts. But having a dialogue with non-scientists is something that we don't get any training in. And part of your question, I think, revolves around this transfer of information and having a common knowledge to work with non-scientists. And that's very, very important. And I think also part of the capacity is the ability to do that. And not, you know, if you're a Homer Simpson fan or a Simpsons fan, it's not dumbing it down, right? It's basically speaking in common language. And quite frankly, as a scientist, I will tell you that a person who can explain a very complex concept to you in simple ways is a person who understands what the hell they're talking about. And the best scientists can do that, or, you know, that are truly translational.
Good. Thank you. Someone has cited an organization called the Trust for America's Health. And although I don't know something to validate the numbers make sense to me from things I've heard. And they're quoting, in 2018, public health spending amounted to approximately $286 per person, just 3% of all healthcare spending in the country. Investment in public health programs saves money by preventing injury and illness, which is particularly important as the population ages. And I take that to be a plug for saying prevention is better than waiting until the problem has occurred. And yet, as you've noted, that's not where we go. So any more thoughts on how we move in the right direction?
Yeah, politically and clinically, there's a reason for why we don't. Why our health systems don't invest in prevention. They have a vested interest, say Kaiser or Sharp or our UC Healthcare. They have patients that they invest in, or insurance companies have patients that they invest in. And if they invest a ton in prevention, those patients, the benefits are really more at a societal level rather than at the health plan level. Kaiser is particularly good because they actually do more prevention than just about anybody else. But they also have ways of enticing their patients so that they stick around, so that they actually see the benefit of that. And some of the most important things that we can do, the big three, for example, on the prevention side, tobacco, eating well, staying fit, right? Those three risk factors account for the four most common diseases everywhere, right? So everything from cardiovascular disease, cerebrovascular disease, diabetes, and those diseases cause half of the death everywhere. Here, New York, the rest of the world, in some places you have more infectious disease, but at the end of the day, it's a chronic disease issue. If we had leadership that would get behind kind of the whole global movement of addressing some of these issues with prevention, I think we would be much farther ahead. And quite frankly, the COVID pandemic is an example. Just think of if we were to attack obesity in the way that we've attacked COVID, right? globally, right? With inoculation vaccines, which, by the way, the inoculation vaccines for obesity are directly tied in with our industrial food complex. What do I mean by that? Well, we have very high calorie dense food, and it's particularly marketed in poor and underserved communities. Fast food, right? And the marketing and engineering company and the marketing companies know that sweet, salty, and sugary are what attracts our palate. And therefore, for the kids, it's cereal on the commercials and blah, blah, blah. For us, it's the Big Mac and the fries. And we go there. We go there. And it's supersized. So the portions are even bigger. So if we were to attack obesity the way we attack COVID, we would have to deal with what we're doing at a national level with the food complex. And we'd have to deal with us moving away from prepared food to creating our own food, right? So to making our own food, to cooking our own food, and so on, and eating less food. So those are, you know, just a lot of complexities there, but, you know, it's part of it on the prevention side.
I'd like to try this experiment that we talked about doing this evening, which is to try some breakout rooms again. We are trying to set up several breakout rooms. I believe it's 7. And for each breakout room, we have hopefully successfully asked someone if they would be willing to take the lead on facilitating the discussion. And the question I have in mind, and Jesse, you should feel free. I'm doing this based on where the conversation has gone so far, but I'm thinking of asking the groups to come up with their suggestions about how researchers can best engage with the community. And specifically, the things to think about would be, well, who speaks for a community? Is it their elected leaders? Is it those who speak most loudly? Is it those who have the most education and ability to speak? Does anyone, and corollary to that is, does anyone really speak for a community? So the general challenge would be to say, is to come up with ideas about how researchers should be engaging with the community. We'd like to hear back from the groups now on what you thought were some ways that you would like your communities to be engaged. And in the hope that you did identify a spokesperson, let's start with group 1. Janelle, yeah. What did you guys come up with?
Yeah, so we talked about a couple different things, but just really quickly, we talked first about showing up for the community and doing that consistently and regularly. And, you know, that might look like different things depending on the community, but really offering your services and having really pure intentions and not just doing it in order to get to an end, but to actually benefit the community as well. And then we also just talked about kind of the challenge of the grant funding models and how it can make it difficult to really invest long-term in a community when so many grants are just funded for short periods of time and with very specific stipulations for how that money is being used, which can make it hard to really benefit the community and address the social determinants of health, which might make longer term impacts.
Thank you. So Jesse, I should ask for each of these if you have any further comments on what the group came up with. And
I just said I think those are spot on, and obviously you have some expertise. Once you start using the social determinants of health, you know, you have folks that know what they're talking about. So
room 2, that I think Mitz was the facilitator of that group. So who is the?
Hi, Michael. I'll just make some comments. Our group felt that, you know, indeed, it all depends, but communities do have networks. They could be based on churches or places where people gather. People have their own dialects, their own activities, fun things, whatever, that then build natural networks. And so this idea of representing a community, well, no, don't. It really depends upon how those communities are already kind of networked. And that can be around, again, food or community organizations.
Good. Thanks, Mitz. So room 3, maybe you can sort of summarize where you were going with your answer.
Yeah, sure. I'm kind of new getting into research, going into a PhD program. But one thing that comes to mind is that since I'm a member of, you know, I'm of a community where most of the research is done, yet interested in doing research with disadvantaged or minority populations, I would need to find members of the research team that are representative of that group. Mm-hmm. And to make sure that they're a part of the team, because they are going to be the ones who are going to be most well-versed in engaging that community. There's no way I could do it without that kind of support. We did have another member who does work on community engagement, and they reach out to veterans and through case management, AA meetings, NAMI kind of places where veterans tend to maybe congregate. They also use resources like Mama's Kitchen or 211 even.
Good. Thanks. And, you know, part of what you were getting into is what I envisioned we might do with this question is instead of thinking about what would that group over there want to be engaged, is to think for yourselves. In other words, what would you be looking for? What would matter to you? And Mary, you've made, if I understood correctly, you made the point that you'd want someone who was like you in the sense of identity, whatever identities you might have, because mm-hmm. if they're absent from that group, then you might feel that they just don't know who you are.
Well, absolutely. I think that that's how any group would feel. They misunderstood.
Irony of this is that that's how so much science has been done precisely in that way. So,
yeah. And I did appreciate what, I'm not sure who said it, but having pure intentions. You know, I think that what we see in minority communities is that the researchers are often white and middle class and scientists. And we have a history of not doing good, you know, equitable research that's beneficial to the community and maybe even abusive. So we need to back away from that.
Jesse, I mean, something just on that. I mean, I think I should turn that to you a bit. I mean, there is this.
Yeah,
history.
Well,
what do we do about that?
You know, recently, you know, white males are the devil, right? You know, way before Malcolm X started and the Nation of Islam started, oh, you know, white populations are the devil. Here's the truth. The truth is that the inequity is almost within the research enterprise because of the separation that it creates and these models that I was talking about as academics, and, you know, that we're in that structure that almost forces us to work in a certain way. And the, I totally agree with you, Mary, this whole issue of addressing diversity, you know, most of us tend to automatically go to like the racial ethnic, right? But regardless of what you're doing, it's so important to involve individuals of the group that you're working with. And it may be race, it may be age, it may be geographic location, it may be having a certain asset or having a certain deficit. And so it's not just about, you know, the whole racial ethnic, you know, when you think disparity or diversity, you think about that. It's these all these other complexities. And again, having individuals, as you mentioned, Mary, having individuals on the team that have worked or are of those populations or of those communities or of those groups is very important. And not just having them there as tokens, right? But having these folks actively involved, preferably in leadership positions. But here's the thing. The thing is that you don't see, there aren't a lot of bilingual, bicultural researchers, you know, on the Hispanic side. If you look at UCSD right now and you look at the folks that are in leadership, you have a lot of East Indians, for example, a lot of East Indians clinicians, a lot of East Indian clinicians in rural areas. And they're of a different culture than Latinos or Hispanics. There are some things that are similar, but there are many things that are different. And if those individuals are leading that research, are they more or less likely to bring in research teams that are of, let's say, Hispanic culture? You'd have to look at the makeup of those teams. But my point is that at certain levels, there are just less and less people to pick from. But then again, there's no excuse. I mean, why would you not have in a Southern California region, border region, why would you not have staffs that are fully bilingual and bicultural, having so many people with the bilingual bicultural side that can be trained and increased, you know, that you increase that capacity? Why would you not have that, right? Those are some of the realities that are there.
Yeah, so it's another thing that, you know, begs the question of, so what can we and what should we do about this? How do we change that? I'm going to leave that as a rhetorical question for right now. So let's move to room four. So Sarah Burke was, I believe, the facilitator. Who's going to speak up for that group?
Hi, Mike. They actually asked me to do it. So like group two, we were kind of interested in this question of who gets to speak for the community, or which is what it, where is the community that we're trying to get access to. And one of the things that we thought is that maybe the health center is not necessarily the only way or the best way to do it, and particularly for reasons of patient confidentiality and other kinds of issues around how patients are handled. But ideas that came out from our group are faith groups, councils on aging, and rec centers, which are providing direct services to the community. We also were interested in mums groups and caregivers as potential community resources that are available and are overlooked all the time in terms of what the community is thinking or where their concerns lie.
Again, you know, this whole narrow focus of research and the work you're doing is going to point you in one direction or the other, unless it happens to be a topic that is so broad that anyone can participate. I'll give you an example of that. Movement, right? Physical activity. And you can focus that in, but on the broader social determinants side of things, or the socio-ecological model, there's a science called built environment, which is related to movement. If you want people to move, you don't focus on the individual as much as you focus on their immediate surroundings. How do you entice them to want to get out there and walk? So parks, right? Sidewalks, safe crossings of streets. Here in San Diego, we have this ongoing, I live in the North Park, South Park area, and there's this ongoing battle of getting rid of parking to put in bike lanes and this, that, and the other. So if you have a big, broad issue like that, you know, it could, but, you know, you want to take advantage of all these different networks and coalitions and groups, not necessarily just for the, you know, the biking piece, but the movement. Water, you know, water quality, water taste would be another one that would air quality and so on. And these, you know, these are the kinds of things that's really interesting because technology, wearables and sensors and this and that and our phones. I think our phones, for example, are a real interesting tool now for traffic or built-in navigate. All the new cars have built-in navigation that have all these pop-ups usually linked to your phone. These are examples of how, you know, you don't even need to talk to people as much as having this technology linked in so that people can put in the information and then it goes out broadly. I think these are the enablers now that potentially facilitate not only information collection, you know, to get input from folks, but massive information on entire regions that can then shape decisions. So I think all of those pieces are important.
So thank you, Sarah. And by the way, just for the record, Sarah was one of the basically co-founders of the Ethics Center, worked with us for quite a few years at the beginning, and then abandoned us for San Francisco. So I'm going to move on now so we kind of finish up. So we'll need to be brief. So room five, anything you can add that we haven't heard already? Who's going to be the spokesperson?
Mike, it's Rachel.
Hi, Rachel.
And I took a lot of notes. And so I guess I'm going to be the spokesperson because I have the notes. similar things, but I thought it was very interesting how the people the individuals in this group defined community. One of them was a definition of community as a collective voice in the sense of leadership, the collective voice and the stakeholder independent of special interest groups. And I'm not doing justice to the discussion because we ran out of time to discuss it. And I think another interesting point that came out, someone earlier mentioned natural networks. One of the members here who's traveled a lot has observed that communities are not necessarily of ethnicity or minorities, as was just recently mentioned, but rather it was a function of diverse individuals that for for whatever reason, ended up living in close proximity to one another. So a proximity-based community that is composed of diverse individuals. We didn't get very far into the discussion of who would be the leaders of this thing. One of the things about the proximity-based community is that they begin to think alike just because they are together. We didn't get into, like I said, leadership of what that type of group would be like. And just to wrap it up in terms of the ethnicity minority, which we tend to, as Dr. Nodora mentioned, we tend to think of those first. Leadership in those areas are very frequently elders or religious leaders and such. So I just thought that everyone pretty much talked about the same thing, the terminology a little bit different. And I found it particularly interesting, the descriptions of what community is, what communities are in descriptions that were contributed by the members of this particular group. And we would have been able to use a lot more time to get it a little bit more into the detail.
We knew everybody needed 3 more minutes.
And at least. At least three more minutes.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you for those thoughtful comments about community and defining what that is. Mm-hmm. Jesse, we don't have a lot of time left, but if you want to comment briefly on that before we go to room 6, which was your room.
No, I think that's absolutely right in terms of, community is such an expansive term. And the reality is that for certain things, it can be formally defined, particularly public health. But for other things, it could be extremely nebulous. I really do like the grouping, collective voices. And it just depends on what you're working on, right? Sometimes it could be a small grouping of individuals, or it could be millions. So it's quite broad. If you're looking to make sustained impact and looking towards policy, right? Advocacy for policy specifically, how do you go about that? And at what level? And I think that's a talk unto itself, quite frankly. And I will say this, public health training rarely includes advocacy, which is ironic, right? Because at the end of the day, public health is about populations, and it is like shaping and influencing health in populations. And the best way to do that, quite frankly, is via policy, via societal action. Yet that advocacy part isn't really emphasized. And then the other thing is most scientists shy away from getting involved politically because of independence, right, for your evidence and so on. But those are kind of some ironic pieces in the area that we've been talking about.
That sounds like a topic for a session on its own, is that tension between being independent and objective and being the scientist, and recognizing that if policies aren't addressing what we know about how these issues are dealt with in the communities, that we're going to do damage. We aren't just not going to help. We're going to do damage.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic that that most scientists turn to politics in old age, right? You think of Einstein and, no nukes and, it's just what happens.
At a young age, you can't afford to do those things.
Exactly.
So we need to wrap up here soon. So very briefly, room 7, who's the spokesperson? That was Lisa, Eiler was the leader of that group, facilitator.
Earl, did you want to say a few things?
Yes. We also talked about identifying trusted community leaders as a first step and mentioned many of those that other groups have. But one that's maybe a little bit different is also finding any philanthropic groups in the community. And also looking at community newspapers, blogs, podcasts, other communications that might help you identify some of the community leaders. And then we moved on to talking about really how to engage in the community by spending time and getting to know the community, holding open forums and having discussions, really fact-finding with members of the community, approaching different services, maybe food banks, other community services, different ways of how you even through the leaders or other organizations that you find members of the community who would be willing to engage with the researchers. And finally, we spoke about really learning and following what the speaker had to say about clear communication using plain language and getting to know the language of the community and not using the jargon and the language of the professionals that may not be clearly understood. And not only asking the questions about what the community wants, but also what would be turnoffs that the researcher might not have an understanding that would be not welcomed by the community, and acknowledging past ethical abuses that often make members of the community fearful of science.
Thank you, Carol. That was a really rich addition to what we already had. So thank you very much for that. And we unfortunately are actually past our close time of 7 o'clock. And we, as I've always said in the past, have an ethical responsibility to finish on time. I want to really thank Jesse for an extraordinarily important topic and discussion. And what I see is a field which has a lot of opportunity to sharpen our thinking, to do better, and to maybe help change some policies that are getting in the way of good science and good health. So Jesse, thank you very much. I want to thank the audience for your participation this evening. I really appreciate the work you did in the small groups. And I also felt I'm going to take the liberty of being the moderator for the program this evening, of using this opportunity to let you know, for those of you who have any interest at all, that I am retiring July 1st. We will have a new director for the Ethics Center effective July 1. And that's Dr. George Hightower, who is part of the program this evening. I will, at the very least, listen in on future programs. But I want to thank those of you who have been with us for many programs in the past and wish you all a good evening.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.